Good morning. You're listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio, 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland. KBOO, this is Cecil Prescott, and this is More Talk Radio. Today is Monday, June 21st, 2010. And for those of you who are partisans of worshiping the sun, well, perhaps another day in Portland, Oregon. I'm told the sun will come someday, and the warm weather will come someday, but not quite yet here in Oregon. We thank you for joining us this morning. We are pleased to continue our ongoing discussion and information sharing about Afghanistan and Pakistan. Joining us this morning is an activist and old friend of not only KBOO, but many in the peace community, Kathy Kelly, who is a coordinator for Voices for Creative Nonviolence, has initiated a long campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare. Kathy recently returned from a visit to Afghanistan and Pakistan and was there able to get a understanding of the situation for many of us, and is in the States now sharing the information she has shared with others. Thank you for joining us again, Kathy.
Hello, Cecil. Thank you.
I think the last time we spoke, or one of the last time we spoke, was around January in 2009, and where you were, organization was involved in a Camp Hope campaign for change. I think when there was so much anticipation of perhaps a change in U.S. policy, evidently that has not yet occurred. And you recently returned from a visit to the region. Could you share something about your recent visit and how things have changed or have not changed since your last visit? Was it a year ago you were last in the region?
That's right. Well, a year ago, we were meeting in Pakistan with people who were very anxious. What would their futures hold? They'd been displaced from their homes. They'd abandoned their fields, their livestock, their livelihoods. And there was a great deal of military campaigning, you know, with helicopters overhead firing missiles into the villages. And people were stuck in various kinds of refugee situations, some in camps, some with relatives, some finding abandoned buildings and squatting. And there was a great anxiety that when they went back, they would possibly not be able to resume any kind of a normal lifestyle. And this trip, we met with people for whom that prediction had come true. We met with a man who had been a pretty, you know, relatively prosperous landowner. He had acres of fruit trees in the border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan in a province called Bajaur. He was satisfied with his life. You know, when I say relatively prosperous, I think we should acknowledge that the vast majority of people in Pakistan live either close to or under the poverty line. So this man wasn't complaining. He liked his life, but he'd had to flee because first the Taliban came to his area and some of his relatives had sided with a military offensive back in 2008 against the Taliban. He was in grave danger. He fled to Afghanistan. Then the Pakistani military took over his home and still occupies it. He cannot go home. So he's been trying to scrape together some way to make a living for himself. And quite honestly, I met him when he was shining my shoes. I hadn't asked him to shine my shoes. He was so desperate that he kind of looked at lots of shoes on the ground in a small cafe, and he thought, well, this woman definitely needs a shoe shine. And anyway, then he came later and sat and talked with us at great length and talked about how he hoped maybe he could become a cobbler, talked about how much he misses his family. He's been separated from them. The women are in a refugee camp, and he's put his sons in a school, a madrasa, that I think might have been set up by people with a pretty fundamentalist vision of how change might happen, a religious fundamentalist vision, but he couldn't figure out any other option. So this was a man who has been, in his life, completely turned around from where he thought his life was going. And he's one of the more fortunate people in many ways. We talked with people who had survived drone attacks, and this is a repeat of what we did last year. This time it was more gruesome and ghastly to listen to a man who said that, you know, people are incinerated by these blasts and that the bodies were carbonized and they couldn't even remove a corpse. They had to get pieces of plastic and try to identify body pieces. Mm-hmm. And then he realized that three of his own relatives had been killed in this blast. And this doesn't go into the news in mm-hmm. the United States at all. That's a constant. That's a given. In Afghanistan, I saw something very hopeful going on in the hospital run by a very respectable NGO called Emergency. I respect them because they've been in Afghanistan since 1999, mm-hmm. stitching up, creating rehab facilities for and getting prostheses for people who have been hit by landmines, by explosives that might have been detonated by the Taliban, by bombs that might have been dropped by the United States. They don't pick sides. They just take whomever comes as their patients. Mm-hmm. And so we sat with children who had been harmed by explosives. And I was so edified that on a bright summer day in a garden that's quite beautiful on the hospital grounds, these kids and some of the older men would sit down in circles and talk with each other, coming from such radically different places, and all of them facing great pain in their future. Mm-hmm. You know, they're missing body parts, or they've been maimed or mangled. But I certainly saw kind of a, I don't know, maybe you could call it something like a peace jirga going on in those hospital grounds.
We're speaking with Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She recently returned from a visit to Pakistan and Afghanistan. As you visited Afghanistan and Pakistan, and you saw signs of hope, I think you said, in Afghanistan, it raises the question for me in terms of the role of agencies who are involved in the region. And specifically, I'm wondering in terms of the role of the U.S. military. At one time, sometimes we hear that the U.S. is involved in nation building. And is that a role that the U.S. military is doing effectively? And if so, is that a role that the U.S. Sees itself as doing nation building in Afghanistan? And is that a proper role?
Well, you know, I don't think the question should ever be what does the United States want mm-hmm. for Afghanistan. I think the question should be what do people of Afghanistan want mm-hmm. for Afghanistan. And I know that's not an easy question, and it's not going to elicit a monolithic answer. But, I mean, here's something that stays in my mind very much. I'm going to go back to that hospital, if you will. And there was a young boy who was maybe, well, actually, he's a young man. He's 22. When he was 18... coming from an impoverished, very, very poor area. And I had visited for several days in that area. Families have 10 to 15 children. They don't have access to clean water. Beautiful scenery, but horrendous conditions. And so to help his family, he decided to take a job as a driver at age 18, working to drive in convoys for the U.S. military. And now he was pretty lucky through the ages of 19 and 20, but when he was 21, the convoy he was driving in went over an improvised explosive device, an IED, and the head car in the convoy had a GPS system, and the final car had a GPS system, but the Afghan drivers in the middle had no way of knowing, you know, if they were in danger. So his vehicle blew up, and he has very, very serious damage to one of his legs and one of his arms. And he was in pretty good spirits, but he told us that the military pretty much abandoned him. Mm-hmm. They dropped him off at a free hospital, and he's never heard from them again. There's no compensation that he's going to be able to get from them, no assistance with the long and arduous rehab that he faces, no question of vocational training so that he might get another job. He was just, you know, a cog in the military machine, and he's been quite forgotten. And I think that in terms of value on human life, mm-hmm. I mean, can we imagine that a drone aircraft would ever be piloted by U.S. pilots in the United States to fly over London and bomb a suburb mm-hmm. of London because mm-hmm. wealthy people who might be supporting an Al-Qaeda operation might live there? We would never do that. We wouldn't bomb a suburb of London because we might kill Londoners. Mm-hmm. But that we might kill Afghan people, that we might kill Pakistanis, that we might kill children who happen just to be living with their families. And people are very sensitive to that, that the value of their life seems so low in the eyes of people in the United States, if it's thought about at all. Mm-hmm. You know, 850 Afghan children die every single day in Afghanistan. Why isn't that part of the headline news?
Why isn't it? It's something that certainly not only absent from the headline news, but from the back pages of the newspapers here in the United States for the most part. And part of the frustration is, why is that the case that we seem to have forgotten this war? Now, isn't this like the longest war the U.S. has been involved in, close to a decade? Are we not, able to raise the awareness of Americans of the horrors that are happening? It's so frustrating.
Well, for instance, it costs $1 million to keep one United States soldier on the ground in Afghanistan for 1 year.
Mm.
So, you know, whichever way you want to do the multiples, you know, mm-hmm. the 9 years of war that we're engaged in, the close to now 80,000 soldiers that will be over there. I mean, this is enormous, enormous cost to maintain an overbloated military defense machine. And there's plenty of machinery that also goes over, and it's something like 22 gallons a day for fuel per soldier when you count in the land-based and the aerial vehicles. And every gallon of fuel apparently costs $400 by the time you've transported it over there and paid off various hostile groups not to shoot at the U.S. convoys. I mean, this is an insane expenditure of U.S. wealth and productivity. And again, in an area that is second only to sub-Saharan Niger in terms of poverty, one-fourth of Afghanistan's children don't live beyond the age of 5 years of age. And sure, there are development needs, and no one ever should deny that. And I don't think United States people should walk away from reparations for suffering caused and damage done. But I don't think that we should rely on the military or the provincial reconstruction teams that are military groups to be accomplishing this kind of change. I think that, you know, development experts are very clear that you have to start at the grassroots level and ask people what do they want and rely on some of their wisdom of having lived in these communities for ages and ages. Now, it's possible that Afghanistan's fruit orchards, mulberry and pistachio and walnut trees could be restored, that irrigation systems could be cleared and created, that the flocks could be replenished. The estimation is that that in itself could cost $34 billion, according to Alfred McCoy's research. But two things: that should not be done under the direction of the United States government and military, and it should be done, I think, through development efforts that start at the grassroots level and involve communities at the very beginning with asking, is this what you want? Is this something that you could sustain? And so there have been kind of show projects that the U.S. has done. They've been written up in the Washington Post. And it reminds me of being in prison, and whenever the warden had people that wanted to visit the prison, he'd show off the one
yes.
nice dormitory that, you know, looked kind of clean and well stacked with cleaning supplies and, you know, plausible as a place for people to live. And they would never see the places that were crumbling and falling apart and, you know, miserable hovel type places. So there are some efforts that are being made, certainly, but it's just a fraction, a tiny fraction of the energy and resource and ingenuity that's being poured into the military. And I think certainly when we think of 21st century warfare, we have to be looking also at the robotized warfare and at the drone attacks.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. Our guest this morning is Kathy Kelly with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. We're speaking this morning about her recent visit to Afghanistan and Pakistan. Hopefully we'll engage you in conversation with our guest this morning. Later on, I hope we'll have a discussion in which we will examine what are the ways in which we can, if not re-energize the peace movement, in ways in which we can offer ways in which we can alter the U.S. foreign policy in that region. Let me remind you, if you are interested in being a part of this conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Is that correct? I think that's the 8187. That's the correct number. And we're continuing our conversation with Kathy Kelly. I think ostensibly when the U.S. went into Afghanistan a decade ago, it was to fight the Taliban, and then we got our military ally, Pakistan, as part of this fight against the Taliban. Could you speak something more about Pakistan and what you saw there in terms of the economy, in terms of people's movement there on the ground, and people's attitude towards their military and to the government?
I think many Pakistanis feel that their whole country has been treated as a kind of poorly paid mercenary for securing so-called U.S. interests in the region. The United States, when it wanted to see the Soviet Union ejected from Pakistan, worked closely with the Pakistani Secret Service, it's called the ISI, to help form the Taliban. I mean, when the United States bombed Taliban encampments going after al-Qaeda groups immediately following 2011, they knew where right where to go because they had built these camps.
Mm-hmm.
So the United States had said that it was going to invading Afghanistan following September 11th, 2001, dislodge and eliminate al-Qaeda presence. Now, it's interesting that as recently as December of 2009, Barbara Boxer said there might be about eight dozen al-Qaeda figures in Afghanistan, but not likely more. And so then people say, well, they've gone over to Pakistan, and Pakistan is supporting some of these figures. Now, there are many, many different Taliban groups, and it could well be that the Pakistani government is still giving support to some Taliban groups. I don't know. It could be that they are being used to help foster negotiation with some Taliban groups. That I also don't know. But it certainly is the case that the United States has consistently said since the spring of 2009 to the Pakistani government, you must do more to eliminate Taliban groups that the United States wants to see attacked. And this has often meant that the Pakistani military has to attack its own civilians. Mm. It has to use air attacks and different kinds of military invasions and occupations, and then it imprisons people and tortures people and tries to wring out of people through horrible methods, okay, were you or weren't you a Taliban member? And if you were, who else was? And where do they live? And these kinds of things that create division and anger and hatred. And then the Pakistani government has pretty well been forced to look the other way and give the nod to United States attacks on Pakistan. We're not at war against Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Pakistan is our ally, but we regularly use unmanned aerial vehicles to fire 500-pound bombs and Hellfire missiles on targets now in North Waziristan and South Waziristan and the Araxai area, even close to Peshawar in this area called Khyber. Well, people in Pakistan are enraged. They already had a low opinion of the United States because they felt that they'd been used by the United States and that the United States had built up a military that's so powerful that now people don't have any option but to be subservient to military demands in their economy. The budget that was just passed gives raises only to the military and the police, and other civil society workers are just desperate to try to get raises in their salaries so they can at least meet the rising sales taxes and now the value-added tax that the IMF says they have to install, and also to pay for utilities. And I mean, this is a very, very grinding poverty that afflicts the people in Pakistan, and they wonder, what does the United States want us to do in terms of do more? We're the ones who then experience the retaliation. If the Taliban groups are attacked and they want to punish somebody for doing that, they'll blow off an explosive at our mosques, at our police stations, at our universities, and people in the United States don't even know this is going on. So there's tremendous rage, honestly.
We're speaking this morning with Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. An article that she and Josh Bollier has recently wrote, Unrest in Pakistan, is on the Voices for Creative Nonviolence website. There's a link to that article on our webpage here on KBOO-FM. Give us a call, 503-231-8187, for a conversation with our guest this morning. We'll go to Joanne. Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning, everybody. Blessings to you, Kathy Kelly. Oh, I want to start crying. Anyway, you know, I heard on Democracy Now! That we have 1,000 billionaires in the U.S., and a while ago on KBOO, I heard that Mexico has even more billionaires than we do. And then I hear about the experts working on reforming the Social Security system. My thinking is they're working on destroying it. You know, I don't like being uncomfortable. I don't like violence. But I don't think peace, being peaceful with these people that are damaging this country and the world, is the way to go. And I have no answers. And I suppose after saying that, the FBI and like people will be keeping an eye on me. Anyway, thanks for the program.
Thank you, Joanne. I think Joanne voiced frustration that many people feel. Do you have a response?
Well, you know, I think when we live in a country where you have a First Amendment right to free speech, we have under international law a big responsibility to exercise it. And I just want to say that I was so surprised. I was at a trial. I came back wanting to be on time for this trial in Washington, D.C. It was last Monday, a week ago today. And I went in thinking, well, I don't believe I committed a crime by being part of a Witness Against Torture 12-day fast that culminated in an action in the Rotunda commemorating the lives of three men who had allegedly committed suicide at Guantanamo. But it turned out that, according to Scott Horton's article for Harper Magazine, it was more likely that they'd been tortured to death. Mm. And so we commemorated them right inside the Rotunda building, and we put down a banner with their names, and we strewed rose petals on the banner, and we softly sang a song. Well, loud enough, actually, to be heard, though, by people on the other side of the room. Anyway, we were arrested, and I didn't think I'd committed a crime, as I said, but I also didn't expect to be acquitted in a court of law. They don't usually find you anything other than guilty as charged. We were acquitted, 24 of us, for holding banners outside on the Capitol steps and for taking this action inside. And on September 14th, we'll go to trial for trespassing at Creech Air Force Base. And it's true, we entered the base. We weren't invited, and but we didn't force our way in as we were charged. We quietly walked in. We, in fact, had pizza and flowers for people at the base. We said we wanted to talk with them about the usage of the drone aircraft.
Yes.
And well, I don't know if we'll be acquitted, but that's one thing you can do. If we act in reactionary ways that can often become violent and, you know, we don't get a chance to think about what we're doing. We're not in control of what we're doing. We just react.
Yes.
Then I don't think we'll be able to create an alternative. The means you use determines the end you get. So I hope we can all echo Joanne's passion, but really search together for ways that will be commensurate to the crimes being committed, but that will envision right in the very actions we take the alternative world we want to build.
I think that's such a wonderful way in which you express that, and it turns us into a direction that I was hoping we would be able to go in this morning in terms of where do we go from here and what are things that we need to do to not only maintain our spirits, but ways in which we can challenge the U.S. military and our economic system to work in solidarity with those around the world to create a world in which we would like to live in. In this challenge to seek a peaceful, just world, what else? How do we maintain that spirit and not allow ourselves to become not only totally frustrated, but allow ourselves to fall victims to the same type of I don't want to say irrational, but nonsensical, I don't know. How do we create a vision that maintains our spirit and allow us to maintain hope?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we can't expect overnight successes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of times we see tactics that get used and used and used over and again, and people say, well, they fail, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When are we going to see something that indicates success? And it's also not going to be risk-free. I can't
mm-hmm.
help but think about the flotilla heading to Gaza
yes.
when people were boarded by Israeli soldiers and a massacre took place. But, you know, in Oakland, California, people went down to the docks and they blockaded the docks and they said, no, we can't allow this Israeli ship to land. We don't want to be having trade relations with a country that has made itself an outlaw by its own practices. And I think this is an interesting thing to consider, that there are many, many people whose passions are awakened by the risk and the sacrifice that has been made as people in Gaza have endured tremendous
mm-hmm.
brutality. And in the West Bank, you know, there are brilliant examples of nonviolent action happening in the West Bank every week, and people are harmed brutally as a result, but these actions haven't evaporated or gone away. So one thing is to form communities who certainly will gather for the outdoor presence, for the vigils,
yes.
but maybe take those vigils inside your elected representative's office so they can't help but see you.
Mm-hmm.
We know a woman, Chris Gond, who every Wednesday for 5 months now has done a die-in. Goes right into her elected representative's office, lies down on the floor, puts her hands on her chest, and says, I'm reenacting the death of brothers and sisters in other parts of the world who bear the brunt of our bombs.
Uh-huh.
And the staffers know her, and they respect her. She's a librarian at Grinnell College, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's good to think about what kinds of actions we can take that are life-giving, that do speak to these truths, and that can help to galvanize the community, but not to lose heart. You know, change isn't going to happen overnight by any means. I think it's also good to take heart from struggles that have gone on in the past here in the United States, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the union movement, and the many efforts towards social change. And what we need is certainly to become many more than we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we need people who have good organizing skills. And I want to suggest that a lot of that organizing skill has been sort of subsumed into efforts to provide entertainment and sports for our children.
Hmm.
And I don't know if the children, as they grow up, will have a habitable planet.
Right.
If
nice.
We don't rearrange some of those priorities. So, I mean, I was out in Chico, California on a beautiful late spring day, and there were no less than 15 uniformed soccer groups in this small town out on the grass playing soccer with their parents and their grandparents and brothers and sisters, and everybody was terrifically organized.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, the Chico activists were having this small little circle of people who were having a peace rally. And I thought, wow, what if the numbers could be changed around a bit so that all of the energy that goes into providing, you know, sports events and play dates and, mandatory gift-giving occasions.
Sure.
And, you know, what if that got directed more assiduously toward organizing for the peace movement? We need it so badly.
We do. We're speaking this morning with Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You are listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. Let me suggest that you continue listening to this station, because at 9 on the old Mo Variety Hour, the Mo's ask, who are the billionaires trying to reform Social Security and what's in it for them? And can prisons be reformed or must they be abolished? Then at 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delter. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, representatives of Portland's Park and Environmental Services talk about a project to restore Oaks Bottom's natural features and functions. At 11 on Health Watch, Barbara Stroke discusses her new book, The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprise and Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind. She will share research on how our brains improve as we age. And at 11:30 on Radio Zine, Emily Young speaks with Sloane Crossley, author of the new essay collection, How Did You Get This Number? All of this here on your community radio station, KBOO-FM. Now we are continuing our conversation with Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She recently returned from a visit to Afghanistan and Pakistan and is here with us this morning speaking not only her visit and the region there, but also in terms of where do we go from here in creating a world of justice and peace. Our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. Please give us a call and ask your question or share your thoughts with us this morning. Kathy, as you mentioned earlier, two things that I wanted to mention. One is the computerized warfare that we are involved in, and second is in terms of how we organize ourselves. I think in terms of, you mentioned the drone aircraft and how that is impacting civilians in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I'm wondering your thoughts on computerized warfare. Was it something, war is always ugly, but is there something different about this type of warfare where we are unable to see the whites in the eyes of the people we are killing?
Well, it certainly makes it more tempting to go to war if not a hair on the head is going to be harmed. There's not going to be a bruise or a scratch on your so-called warriors. Mm-hmm. Because they're not going to be in the war zone. They're going into a dimly lit trailer in Crete Air Force Base or maybe at Hancock Air Force Base in Syracuse now. Mm-hmm. Davis Monahan is doing training. They're not going to be displaced at all from the normal routines of their day, except that over the course of the day, as someone is monitoring a camera, if that person thinks, hey, I think I've got some people who might be digging a hole. They might be burying an improvised explosive device. Now, on the other hand, they might be farmers. They might be digging a hole because they're going to plant something. And it's mm-hmm. very hard to know exactly. And so they watch and they monitor and they get a lot of other people in on the discussion, and what's called a kill chain forms up. And then at some point, somebody's going to finally have to make the decision, yes, we think this family or this grouping of people should be what would be called a high-value target. And when that decision is made and the order is given to kill, then the person who is monitoring the drone and also operating the drone's progress in the skies can basically push the buttons, and a Hellfire missile or a 500-pound bomb can be lobbed right into a home or a cluster of people. Now, the people who have watched these explosions on screens, according to Jane Meyer, have commented that it's really pretty horrifying. There's a huge blast on the screen, and then all you see is rubble and charred stuff. Mm. That's how one CIA analyst referred to the results. And the CIA agents say that the Marines actually also say that you sometimes see some bodies flying away from the scene, and they call those people squirters.
Hmm.
Well, listening to people describe having been in Mehran Shah when drone attacks occurred, and that the force of the attack actually flings other bodies clear across wide space until they crash into a stone wall, and that causes multiple fractures and injuries. And then hearing people talk about how frequently after one hit, the rescuers come to try to pull people out from under rubble or take people whose bodies are on fire and get them out, now are risking their own lives because 15 minutes later, another drone will be fired. The order will be given again. And this means that the rescuers are presumed to be, quote, bad guys. And so people now, as a practice, don't go to rescue people until about an hour or so has passed. Well, these are nightmare scenes, horrible scenes. And can you imagine, a young child, I read about Israr Khan Dawar. He's 16 years old, and he lies just rigid in his bed at night, hearing the sounds of the drones come closer and closer, and he fully expects that at some point one of these bombs might be fired right into his home and kill and maim and mutilate his loved ones and maybe he himself. And where are people going to go if they survive? I mean, we're talking about villages that are so small, there's not even a road into the village. And people carry the survivors on their shoulders and try to run for help across unpaved areas. Is there no mercy for children in these situations?
Where is our humanity? Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning. Would that be me?
Yes, it is you.
Hey, I want to thank the guests for today's show. Thank you very much, guest.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I do want to ask you a question. We've had a lot of attacks from Al-Qaeda in the past 5 to 7 years. And I would like to ask you, guest, how many of those Al-Qaeda attackers have been Jews or Israelis?
Oh, you know, I think we don't really know who participated in the September 11th attacks. You know, I think that people were identified as having been from Saudi Arabia, from Yemen, from, there was one from Egypt. And to me, I don't know that trying to identify nationalities is the best thing to do. I think if you want to counter terror, build justice. Mm-hmm. Build just and fair relationships with other people, and maybe not be asking so much, well, what country are you from, and what does the government of your country say about the government of our country? I think if we want to reduce the numbers of people who would engage in terrorist acts, we should look in the mirror and see ourselves as people who have engaged in many actions that terrify other people, both state-sponsored and non-state-sponsored. But a lot of times it has to do with our economic practices and how much of the world's resources we consume. And I realize this is a really different approach than what may be on your mind. But that's part of the spirit of Cecil Prescott's radio show.
Thank you. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning. Turn down your radio. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes, it's you.
Oh, okay. Hi, my name is Rabab. I kind of had the radio on, too, so I wasn't sure about the timing, but sure. I'm on the air, right?
Yes, it's you. Yeah, turn down your radio. Uh-huh.
Okay, I wanted to say how very, very grateful I am for this program today and for you, Kelly. Kathy Kelly, excuse me, and the work that you're doing. I think some of us out here have more of a passion than others and a calling to really feel what's going on. And for me, it started way back probably in Desert Storm, and it's just grown since then, the anger and rage and how horrified I am with what's going on in the world with violence. And the only consolation I'm really having right now, hearing about this, because it's just so hard for me to even face that they're still doing the drones, but to know that there is a organization like Voices for Creative Nonviolence that I can get involved in and really be dedicated. I feel like there's nothing, really very few things more important that I can do right now with my life, because I sit and I listen and I educate myself on everything going on, and then I just feel so helpless. It's like there's nothing I can do and except for sit and pray and maybe express my feelings to someone. And these drones are about the final straw for me. It's just so ugly, and I've really been supportive of President Obama, but that's one area that I'm really disappointed in. And I just want to say one more thing. I think the whole oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is obviously a very horrible thing, but when you think about what we've used that oil for, and that in a roundabout way, it actually probably contributes to violence and war and killing innocent people, it makes me wonder, you know, why aren't people more as outraged over this as they are over a tragic accident that took place, and which is obviously really, really, really horrible, but I think the loss of human life is much worse. So, final thought, I'm just very thankful that you're here, very, very thankful that you're doing what you're doing, very thankful that you went overseas. And I'm going to go online on the web and just continue to be as active and as involved as I possibly can be. Really glad that you guys exist. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
She expressed not only the frustration, but also the hope that many of us have. Many of us either feel powerless or we feel as if there's nothing we can do. And I think, Kathy, you have been able to express with us over the balance of your life's work that it is possible to maintain hope as we work for positive social change.
Well, you know, anytime I've had an opportunity to come to Portland, I've always been so impressed with activists in your own community. So that's one very hopeful thing. The community college system has quite a few good peace actions and very fine activist teachers, and so I've always been glad to see that. My friend Michael Sunleitner teaches peace courses in several of the community colleges, and in fact, he had gone to Afghanistan at a very young age and went and met Badshah Khan, so there's a wonderful resource right there.
Yeah.
I've been impressed by the Catholic worker efforts and the integration between scholars and workers, if you will, that I see going on in Portland because of, for instance, Tom Hastings is over at the university, but he's also been active with Catholic Worker. Peaceworks, Portland Peaceworks and Cop Watch with Dan Hastings, who is like a co-founder to Voices for Creative Nonviolence because of his involvement in opposing the economic sanctions. And certainly KBOO Radio and yourself, Cecil and Jenka, and so many others. So I think there are always local actions to be involved in, and that's a bit related to the concern about consumption. I mean, I still travel a lot around the United States, but I'm really trying to stay off the planes and to go by bus and train, or not to go, you know, because of the need to be more conservative about energy expenditure. So I guess in that way we can be glad for the web. We do want to invite people to join us in our efforts to oppose the drone development, like Alliant Tech, for instance, creates a component for firing the Hellfire missiles that are loaded onto the drones, and Boeing has been involved in drone development, and the Aerospace Institute at Purdue University, we now find, has spawned several startup companies, and there's one called Light Machines, L-I-T-E, that's making mini drones. One's called the Voyeur. It's like a helicopter rotor, you know, a helicopter without the copter. And these mini drones will be certainly used in nefarious ways, maybe even on our own border with Mexico. So there's so much to become involved with, and I hope people can make the links locally that will help them to build a more and more active nonviolent resistance. And there's a great history of that in the Portland area.
Certainly. And I'm still speculating on how to organize my neighborhood children's soccer league for peace. Thank you for planting that idea in my mind. Let's go to our next caller. Good morning, and thank you for waiting.
Hi, Cecil, this is John. I wanted to comment on something that Kathy said, and it ties into the sports thing. I volunteer at a history museum that is right next to a super huge sport complex, and we have our monthly family days, and we're happy if we can get 100 people in there, and right next to us, hundreds and hundreds of kids are out playing sports, and the parking lots are jammed, and occasionally we get a spillover, and a few people come by, and they mostly tend to be mothers with young girls. We don't see very many little boys. And it seems to me, and you know what we do, we offer these programs where the kids can do crafts, and they can learn how to make crafts that are tied in with Native American skills and things like that. They get an opportunity to look into the past, maybe get a better grounding into who they are as human beings. And you know, it would be so easy for parents to assume a greater role, to realize that parenting is more than writing checks and chauffeuring to soccer practice, that actually instilling some sort of ethical basis in the children is also a part of parenting. Anyway, that's what I wanted to add. I really enjoy this this hour, and I'll take my answer or comment off the air. Thanks.
Thank you. We're speaking with Kathy Kelly. Kathy Kelly, parenting for peace is a great idea, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. And there's no greater vocation, certainly, than being a parent. But, you know, I learn a lot when I'm in other countries and watch children. You know, they're so prized and loved. But you don't see the same level of, like, adult involvement in their play, honestly. Hmm. And it maybe I feel nostalgia. I mean, I just remember being a kid. You know, we would all go outside and we'd kick a can around or, yeah, you know, hours and hours of dodgeball or something. But believe me, nobody was arranging play dates for us when I was a kid, you know. And you got on your bicycle and you rode as far as you could.
Without a helmet?
Yeah, oh, my goodness. So I don't know. I wonder... it's a very big challenge to assume our adult responsibilities in this world, and we would be in many ways very sane and understandable if the adult responsibilities looked so overwhelming that we decided to dive into, you know, becoming like big children ourselves almost. Who would blame anybody? I mean, there's so many big problems to try and solve. But if we aren't going to be about trying to solve the problems about overconsumption and pollution and weapon proliferation, we certainly can't expect the 6 and 7-year-olds to sort it out.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I'm sort of wondering, could we rearrange our priorities a bit, you know? And really, there's a lot to learn also from other people, particularly in the culture of Islam. You know, when they approach Ramadan, which they will in mid-August of this year, when it's very, very hot, and a lot of the Muslim communities, weather-wise, just plain hot, they'll go for a month not eating any food until the sun goes down, in fact, not taking any water. And they do it as a way to encourage their families and even the children to better understand the plight of people who don't have food and water. And for a month, every day, they'll save the money they would have spent on food and beverage all day long, and then they'll have more money to share with the poor. I mean, that's not something to be terrified of, is it?
No.
It's something to be edified by.
And I think in our culture, where we have been overwhelmed by materialism and consumerism, that we've forgotten that. And in fact, you know, if we examine many of the best of Western civilization in terms of being compassionate and caring, if we recall or remember those lessons, that we can recreate them and reintegrate them into our daily lives of being passionate and compassionate and giving towards others.
And it's interesting because even people I know who maybe have become more secular and are not so tied in with a mosque community have very fond memories of the month of Ramadan in their growing up years, and they look forward to it, and they think that this is a time in their lives that where you kind of slow down and you rearrange your routine, and you expect to be with family every night, and it's kind of a gas for kids, you know, to be running around with all the cousins. So I think, you know, maybe for all of us to slow down and to think about where our lives are going and how we can redesign our lives. It can be interesting. It can be energetic, you know. It doesn't have to be onerous or drudge-oriented. And let ourselves really love our children, just love them so much that we would change our lives for them.
Yes. Well, in the few minutes we have left, I want to shift the conversation just slightly and talk about our national agenda in terms of influence public policy. And want to go back to how we should approach the present administration. Many people supported the president when he was running, hoping, regardless of the evidence, that he would be a sign of peace. Should the approach we have to this administration differ from the prior administration? Are there any allies for peace within the administration? Are there ways in which we have areas of influence in State Department, Department of Defense, the White House?
Well, I think we should always try to build links with the faith-based communities, with the university communities, with the labor communities, we shouldn't expect that the Obama administration would depart radically from what President Obama said on the campaign trail, which is that basically Afghanistan would be his war. Mm-hmm. But I think we can hope to create a change within the Obama administration. It's a time when the resources being poured into the war are so needed in order to engage in a war on poverty in our own country. And I think those resources could be far better directed if we had a more wise and sensible approach toward respecting Afghan development as something that they should be able to design for themselves. So I think it makes sense to continue trying to contact elected representatives and to say, you know, enough is enough with this war. We want these troops home. President Obama has said July of 2011, and we want to hold him to that. And to keep your eye on General McChrystal as somebody who simply has not been genuine in his presentation of his desire to protect people in Afghanistan. It's just not true. You've got to look at it. You know, but we have on our website a list of atrocities that have been committed against Afghan civilians because of night raids and attacks on convoys. And, you know, it happens, and the United States defends it, and then a month later they say, oh, well, we're sorry, that was wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think there's going to be more and more scrutiny of those kinds of actions, which would give President Obama perhaps more of a chance to say, look, these military solutions are not working, and help him get out from under the kind of vice-like grip of the Pentagon in terms of the budgets that he can put forth. But I also think President Obama has articulated a belief in exceptionalism, that the United States can tell other countries, you can't use violence, you've got to sort out your problems in other ways, but we are the exception to the rule. Mm-hmm. Somehow we're still the city on a hill, or we're the light that's supposed to be brightly beaming for others, while we've got more nuclear weapons than any other country on Earth, and we're the world's chief arms exporters. We've got to change that. So I think even if it doesn't seem like people on Capitol Hill will ever listen to us, we should be radical, consistent, and determined in calling for a nonviolent revolution in this country. Nothing less than abandoning the military is what would make sense to me.
Amen. Let's see if we can get this last caller in.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, good morning, caller.
Good morning.
Yes.
So what we're dealing with is corporate media brainwashing of society through military complex funding. Disney, all these huge corporations, there's only, what, seven of them that run all of Hollywood and our mainstream cable and all that stuff. So really what we're looking at is we've got to break through the unknowing, the unconsciousness, and get to the television and destroy that from the inside out and change the way money works. Because until we do that, we will never do anything, because they're getting to our children at a kindergarten age, and they're programming the children through alpha waves and all these things that they're using in the media to destroy their ability to critically think and to be compassionate and to be caring for others. So what we need is, for example, if the media...
And we have about 15 seconds, caller.
If the media took on the cause of sustainability and they changed all the programming to sustainable, our country would be more sustainable in probably a year. So, you know, but until the media does something, we ain't going to go nowhere. So we've got to get into the media and get rid of it. Thank you. And corporations are not people.
Okay, bye. Thank you. Kathy Kelly, thank you for joining us this morning. Any last words before we have to part for the moment?
Well, I'm Myself, very grateful to each of your callers for their comments, and I think that taking these conversations into our communities and emphasizing that we are ready to rearrange our priorities, I think this is very encouraging and hopeful. I certainly welcome people to come to our website at www.vcnv.org, and perhaps there's some way that this idea of challenging the drone development, the robotized warfare development, could kind of come home to roost in Portland as you look to see what kinds of corporations are involved in fostering that or university research. At any rate, we certainly look forward to common goals being reached.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Kathy Kelly, and thank you for your good work.
Thank you. Bye now.
Goodbye. You've been listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. We will speak with you next week.